that's something we're pretty excited about. And again, it is an effort or a project that is being done on the appropriate scale to affect this land use activity. We also do large-scale education and outreach efforts associated with irrigated agriculture, and the board has provided funding for those efforts. C-Camp has played a major role in establishing our irrigated ag program, and I think you could say it played the major role in convincing all of the stakeholders that we needed to take these efforts to actually establish the program. And we have begun implementing enforcement actions with respect to this program. The proposal today is for to provide funding for a low-impact development center and low-impact development expertise. Staff at the Water Board will not be providing the services. The money does not go to staff. It does not go to the Water Board in any way. Our proposal is to initially set aside $100,000, and we will work with municipalities to identify specific projects where low-impact development principles need to be applied. In our view, they need to be applied everywhere, of course. We want to work with municipalities and identify specific large-scale projects where they are willing to implement some state-of-the-art practices. We've got a lot of verbal support from municipalities and environmental groups and other stakeholders over the past 3 years for doing this. We realize that that kind of support does not guarantee success. What really matters is actually getting these things implemented, getting low-impact development design principles implemented. And so we're trying to minimize the risk to the board's investment. By setting aside $100,000 initially, we will find out if this works. And if it does work and if the demand is there, if we are successful, we will then set up the $2 million as an endowment, and the interest from that would go to providing these services on an ongoing basis from the low-impact development center to the municipalities. Again, staff will not be providing the services itself.
But what about secretarial and other support-type services within that first year or so? Where's that going to come from?
If we are successful in identifying projects and the municipalities are willing to work with us, we would use the $100,000 to hire experts, as we have on other complex projects that the board has managed, such as the power plant projects and major cleanup sites. We find the experts, we hire them, and they then work with the other party to implement the low-impact development design standards. They would submit invoices to us, staff at the Water Board. We would process the invoices.
Okay, so there would be invoices not just for the retention of experts, but could be for secretarial help and things of that nature.
Yes, there's very low, you know, in the times we've done this before on other projects, there's almost insignificant administrative work associated with it. The independent experts would send us their invoices. This is literally all it is. They send us their invoices. We review them, make sure they did the work, and we process them.
Is this done by contract?
Yes.
With an expert?
Yes. We've done it a couple of different ways. We've set up a contract which describes the type of work that the expert would do, and then we just compare the invoice to that and verify with the municipality that they're actually doing that work.
A cap for the services?
Well, the $100,000 would be the cap initially.
Well, but not to one expert on one project.
No.
That's what I mean. If you've got a couple of projects, or hopefully more than that.
Mm-hmm. We haven't thought about a cap in that sense, like per project, and because we don't know what's going to happen. You know, we don't know what the reaction of the municipalities is actually going to be. Okay. Like I say, we've gotten a lot of verbal support, but that does not guarantee that they will actually participate.
Dr. Press?
Well, first of all, I think that what you're trying to do here is really visionary. I think there's this is thinking in a very different way. And it really is different, and I applaud the staff for doing that. I think that the low-impact development, like other environmental issues is potentially a real growth sector in the economy, what we're calling now green-collar jobs. And it could potentially be very important. I know on the educational side that our students are very interested in this emerging field. They have very few opportunities for training. So one of my, I have a number of questions. One of them has to do with how this center would make a difference in the kind of pipeline of a training pipeline that might really produce a workforce that is going to be available for municipalities, landscape architects, designers, contractors, builders, to. So that's one concern. And similarly, in what sense is this a center, really? There isn't yet a proposal in here that sounds like a center. If you're not going to have a support staff, if it's not housed in a particular organization or institution, maybe it will be. I'm not sure that the word center may be premature at this point. And finally, you have $100,000 a year. I could burn through $100,000 a year in 5 minutes, and I could do it in several ways. I could hire 5 people to teach 5 classes, 5 and a half, 6 classes, depending on their expertise and their overhead. I could hire, I could cost share with 3 projects, municipal projects. So I'm a little...
It's not enough money.
There's not a whole lot of money, but it's not clear from the proposal how it will, how far it'll stretch and how much of a difference it'll make. So maybe you could speak to all those issues.
I'll try. As far as the learning part of it, one of the reasons we have been thinking about establishing the center, if we get to that point, if we're successful and we get to the point where we're setting up a center, one of the things we're thinking about is having it located at a university. And part of the agreement with the university is that it's the center works to change the curriculum in the university. And we've had some experience of that before. For instance, at Cal Poly, we worked with them on their grazing. They have about 6,000 acres of grazing land around the university. And several years ago, they were overgrazing and had cattle in the forced into the riparian areas, and there was a lot of degradation. So we did a paired watershed study with them, demonstrated appropriate grazing management techniques, and 3 years into, it was a 10-year study, 3 years into the study, they said, we get it, we want to convert the whole 6,000 acres to the new way of ranching, and that particular part of the 6,000 acres, which is 2 sub-watersheds, we said, no, you have to keep hammering this one, and you have to keep maintaining the good practices on this one, because we want to show the difference, the statistical significance over 10 years, and we did that. But anyway, after 3 years, they were convinced. They then changed the curriculum in their programs. We see the same thing happening here, as if we are able to establish it at a university, that it will help change the curriculum in multiple disciplines, civil engineering, environmental engineering, landscape architecture, and so on.
I would just interject that a lot of universities get it. They don't need persuasion that this is valuable, important. They actually need a little money to hire the temporary lecturers who start to teach the curriculum long enough to get the student enrollments that justify the permanent faculty positions, which then are there to make it permanent. So I would ask that and urge that if this center were located at Cal Poly, that the money for course development not reside only at Cal Poly, but throughout the region, and I'm not just speaking for UC Santa Cruz here. Actually, I'm even thinking of the community colleges that might make really very good use of temporary academic staffing funds demonstrate the enrollment demand and then be able to use that to justify permanent courses.
Yep. I mentioned Cal Poly not because we have decided in any way or are even leaning that way. I only mentioned that as an example. Part of the way we see this rolling out is that part of the utility of setting aside the $100,000 initially and using that is finding out the interest from not only the municipalities, but where are the experts and what are their abilities? How successful would they be? So it's a test. And we have, on the positive side of this, we have the Low Impact Development Center of Maryland coming here next week. They want to meet with us. They want to collaborate with us and help us set it up. That's huge because they're the leading, in my personal opinion, they're the leading organization of its kind in the United States, perhaps the world. They're coming here next week. They want to help us set it up, and they've already done it. The UC Davis Center for Water and Land Use Management is also interested. They've said they will do anything they can to help us set it up, including, they even said, set up a branch of their organization here. I just talked to Al Wanger with the Coastal Commission yesterday, and he submitted a comment letter this morning, and he said that he's very excited about the idea. He wants to collaborate with us and help us set it up, find grant funding to match funding to build up the center. And we had a conversation about how $2 million is not enough. We all realize that. It's nowhere near enough. But we're hoping that it's a start. And so these other organizations, the Resources Legacy Fund Foundation, you know, we met with Mike Weber. Same thing. He said, this is the kind of project we want to see. And he said, what he's doing is waiting to see what the board's commitment is.
Michael,
all of these organizations are waiting to see what the board's
commitment is. So what is the measurable goal for phase one?
For me, it would be getting municipalities to actually use these services, use these expert services, and design and build model low-impact development projects so that we could go there and look at them and see them. As an example,
that's very concrete and hands-on to me. I mean, I can identify with that. I'd like to see the funds initially used to get projects in the ground. The phase two stuff is somewhat vague at this point as to what it really looks like.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So, if we were to go along with the recommendation and the request, is this for a green light on phase one and phase two, or are we getting, I think you said, is it a quarterly report? So that was CCAMP. No? Is it LID and CCAMP?
Yes, both. And
page 7 of the staff report.
Yes, both. We would bring
quarterly.
Back regular reports to the board on our progress. And at those board meetings, I would expect the board to direct staff if you felt it was necessary to do so. But if the board approves this, we will use the approval to start talking to these other organizations and get match funding and design the center, proper design for the center.
So
we can't do that.
The ideal result would be in a year or at the end of phase one, that you'd be able to show us slides of projects and possibly some other measurable, some other metrics like students or short courses or something like that, right?
Yes. And what I would like to show you are projects, on-the-ground projects.
I'd like to see training also, because projects, you take somebody, you find the few people who know what they're doing and they demonstrate it, but you haven't necessarily increased the workforce that is trained to do this. And I'm concerned that that this region, if you're going to create a low-impact development center, there ought to be a jobs component, a jobs and training component there. I mean, to draw an analogy to another area, the solar photovoltaic industry is taking off, but they don't have enough installers. They physically don't have enough bodies to actually put the panels up on the roofs and the inverter. They cannot do it. And so we need to make sure that we have the expertise. That's jobs, that's potentially well-paying jobs, why should we have to import them from elsewhere, from other regions? We should train them here.
Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps with part of that phase one, staff could be telling us what is available in terms of expertise and bodies to actually...
And training.
And training. And
yes.
Where could we support training
mm-hmm.
in the region?
Yep.
So
I agree. Dr.
Hunter.
Getting back to the other agencies and programs that are interested, I know that you had a chance to meet with some of the folks involved at the Ocean Protection Council.
Yes.
And I'm aware that in January, staff recommended that LID be a high priority, and considering that they're currently laying their strategy for expending about $90 million in 3 years.
Yes.
I'm hoping that they're interested and that they have an idea about how to use some of those funds, because I think the link to between land use and impacts to the marine environment, this is a strong place, and I happen to notice that Ryan Broderick's letter on this issue mm-hmm. noted very succinctly, healthy watersheds equals healthy marine protected areas. So I'm curious, they're not on there on the list here,
yes.
but I think
yes.
you mentioned it in staff report.
Yes. Roger and I traveled to Oakland and met with Neil Fishman, and he's deputy director of the Coastal Commission, and several of his staff. I didn't put the Ocean Protection Council on here because I think of them as the same.
Coastal Conservancy.
You said
commission.
Oh, yeah, Coastal Conservancy. Neil Fishman's the deputy director of the Coastal Conservancy. I think of the Coastal Conservancy and the Ocean Protection Council as the same folks. They share the same staff. But we were talking to both organizations when we were there. And Mr. Fishman said that he supported what we were doing. We went through our whole process of establishing a vision and goals and why we were doing what we were doing, and he said that all state agencies should be doing that. So he applauded us for that. And he said that he wants to figure out a way to help us fund this effort. He mentioned the large amount of Ocean Protection Council funding. We started brainstorming ideas about how you could use grant funding to set up endowments. And that set off a pretty good discussion among all of us. There are at least five of us there, and how that could legally be done. And they thought that it was a novel idea, because typically what we do with grant funds is you grant X amount of money and then hope that it results in something tangible. And in this case, what we were emphasizing is that for our own board and for their board, and for other organizations, if we set this up as an endowment and they do not get the performance that they are after, they can direct the money elsewhere. And so we left it as we were going to go, continue to brainstorm, they were going to continue to brainstorm, and we would see what this board does and get back together.
I'm really encouraged by that report, because of the agencies listed there, the Coastal Conservancy has a lot of flexibility in the way they support and develop programs. And if they are thinking about how to do such a creative model for doing this kind of work, that's the very kind of thing that the OPC is empowered to do, is to reform governance and the state's resources in a way that's going to achieve goals and maximize the dollars that get spent. Mm-hmm. So I think that kind of a proposal has great appeal, and I would mm-hmm. do everything I can to support it as it moves forward to the OPC to consider further.
Mm-hmm.
They'll have to be involved with approving
yes.
any kind of structure. It is the Coastal Conservancy that is kind of the bursar for the funds, but the OPC itself has the
yes.
decision-making power, so
mm-hmm.
I didn't want to let that go by the wayside here in
yes.
these comments.
We talked about, depending on the board's decision today, Roger and I and Neil Fishman talked about us coming back and speaking to the Ocean Protection Council at one of their meetings.
But Mr. Shellcross.
Yeah. Thanks.
I'm watching down.
I think this is a great idea. I have some concerns along with Dr. Price. $100,000 is not very much. This board spent $50,000 fairly recently on a consultant to do some LID work for one of our folks, and it turned out to be basically useless as far as I could see. It was pretty much a cut and paste job from other documents. It wasn't what the person who we were doing the work for had in mind. They found it pretty useless. So I think $100,000 is not a whole lot. I'd like to see more up front, but in order to support it, I'd like to see a more complete, I think your ideas are great. I think you're going the right direction, but I'd like to see, a more complete proposal on just specifically what it's going for. You're saying, well, $100,000 is for some consultants to do something. And I'm not even clear what you're going to be paying them to do, because it doesn't sound to me like you're really clear yet at this point. And I'd just like to see a little more specificity in what the money's going for. I'd also like to see a little more money up front, just because I think $100,000 doesn't get you much. And for someone to say, you're looking at maybe having a $2 million endowment, and you're only putting $100,000 up front to get results, to get that $2 million. I think if you want some good results, you might have to come up with a little more money than that up front. So I'd like to see a little more up front, a little more specificity. I think you're definitely going in the right direction. I totally appreciate this idea. I think it's great. But also, if you're working with jurisdictions, this is the downside on the timing on this. You're working with jurisdictions. A private company in a year can do a lot. Jurisdictions, boy, they really grind through. They have to take it to their board. The board only meets so often. They have to do a public outreach process. So if you're thinking of getting a jurisdiction to have a project on the ground in a year, I think you're incredibly optimistic. And so I think you're sort of setting yourself up for some failure here that I don't want to see. Mm-hmm. So I'd be more comfortable if you came back at another time with a little more completely thought out and a little more detail in this, because I really want to see this work. Mm-hmm. And I don't want it to see it fail just because $100,000 wasn't too much, and then we give the $2 million to something else, and we still don't have anything on LID. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay, there's a... that's fair. I think there's somewhat of a catch-22 here. When you have organizations like these other potential funding organizations, Resources Legacy Fund Foundation, and support from the LID Center from Maryland, they want to know what our commitment is before they invest either their match funding or their own personnel resources to help us. So, like I said, the LID Center of Maryland, Neil Weinstein, is coming here to meet with us next week. And if we say to him, for example, the board has approved our proposal to set aside $2 million or $2.1 million for this effort, it's serious. And now let's start building the process and the LID Center. What would that center actually look like? So
yeah,
that's part of it.
What would it look like?
Yeah, that's part of it. And I hear what you're saying about the other part, with the initial $100,000 not being enough, and what are they actually going to be hired to do? I see what you're saying. And the way we're looking at it is, I would just be repeating myself, but we're looking for actual projects, development projects, that these experts will help overcome obstacles on. I'll give you an example. In July, I wish we had this item in July, because the city of Salinas set us up perfectly for it, but we ran out of time on the agenda and couldn't do it. The mayor and the city manager and the city attorney all stood up, went to the microphone and said, LID's great, we love it, we're going to do it. Then the fourth person who went up was the city engineer, and he said, this is all great, where it's this big love fest here over LID, but I'm the city engineer, and I'm here to tell you that a lot of what you are requiring is not possible. He said, it conflicts with standard civil engineering practices. That is what we need to address. It's the same thing the city of Seattle had to address multiple times. It's the same thing that other communities that have actually succeeded in implementing LID projects have had to address. We need to find experts who can sit down with the city engineer and show him, work with him to implement these design standards. That's not me. It's not anyone on our staff. It's another external expert. And that's what we'll be doing. That is about as specific as I can get with it. We'll be hiring a person who has the expertise to sit down with the municipality's experts and walk them through how to design these types of projects.
And then, you know, we're also left with the problem of what if you can't find a jurisdiction who's interested?
Yes. And then we don't spend the money. If there's no demand for it, we don't spend the money. We don't set up the center. Okay. And we're back to the Water Board's stormwater program, which includes enforcement. If they do not implement the low-impact development design standards and the hydro modification controls that we are requiring, we move to enforcement.
I think we'll find interested jurisdictions.
Okay.
Myself, yeah.
I'm just trying to look at all the possibilities.
Right, and if we don't, then the money sits in the bank. You know, if we can't, we'll have to find another use for it. Yeah.
The board's, I do want to point out, the board's stormwater program and its enforcement capabilities has the strong potential to create demand.
Dr. Press.
I'll just keep this brief because I know you want to get to a public comment. But I think the staff has a good point about putting our money where our mouths are and sending a signal to the entire region and beyond and funding agencies that we're serious about this. And so I do take seriously the urgency. I think there's a low risk here, and I say that because I think the staff, partly because of my regard for the staff, but also because you heard some very detailed questions that we'd like answered about the nature of the center, about the nature of projects, about the nature of training. I agree with Mr. Shawcross that the money is not quite high enough, and I have some ideas about that. But I'd say we ought to green light this so that we can get going, and then we need to see. I don't want to wait a year. I want quarterly reports or every other board meeting or something like that.
Mr. Jeffries?
Quick question. Talk about a regional center. What is a regional center? How far does it reach? What does it encompass?
Our region would be our focus at this time. We would house it somewhere initially, whether it's in San Luis Obispo or north or south. Is optional, but the jurisdiction is the Central Coast, is the board's jurisdiction. That would be our focus. The state board's input on this is that they like the idea, they support it, but they said you need to make it statewide, and we responded that we need to start somewhere. You know, we can't just do it statewide, and anyway, that's their job. You know, our job is to start with the Central Coast, and then if it's successful, it will leapfrog to other areas of the state, other regions.
Well, I can see this could be an overwhelming situation because you talk about 6,000 housing units in Santa Maria. That's just a drop in the bucket what's going to happen in Salinas Valley.
Okay.
And I was wondering how big of the regional facilities is and how far it's going to reach. And then, if that's the case, our whole region is what you're telling me. Isn't that going to be overwhelming?
If we tried to do it all at once, yes. But we have to start somewhere.
Oh, I understand that. But then, I think I'll echo what some of my colleagues already have said, $100,000 is not going to cut it, to be realistic. If we expect to accomplish anything, I think it's going to take a lot more money to initially get this started than $100,000. Because one consultant could eat that up in no time at all. Mm-hmm. And consultants have a tendency to make things last a long time.
Yes, they do.
But the issues, and I think somebody addressed how complex cities operate and governments, they move very slowly and very mysteriously. And I can speak from a lot of experience. The time they go through traffic commissions, planning commissions, public hearings, and council actions or county actions, whatever they happen to be, is going to take a long time for that to happen. Not only that, but getting it through LAFCO to make these different projects, but not take a whole lot of time. I echo a lot of sentiments and concerns, and especially the dollar amounts. If we really want this project to work, and I'm not saying we have to throw a whole lot of money at it, but I think we have to be realistic. If we really want it to work, then we've got to put the money where it's most going to be used, in the right places.
You know, what about if we went along with agreeing to the $100,000, and then we can just, you know, check in with staff. Will be giving us quarterly reports, and we can just see how they're doing and what the need is. If, in fact, they do need to go beyond that,
would we tap into the endowment
right now?
Are you saying that we would revisit that $2 million as an endowment?
Yeah.
Okay.
That I think because I don't know of. Either you say $100,000, but and Mr. Jeffrey says, you know, more, and other board members say more, but how much more?
I don't know.
And so I don't mind getting it started, and then they can start to do some work, and then they have to report back to us so we get a little picture, and you've got more detail to give us back after what you've heard from Dr. Press and Mr. Shallcross that we could.
If you're suggesting that we just do the $100,000 part and not the $2 million endowment, then I would suggest no.
Isn't the $2 million endowment
then don't do anything.
Phase two? Isn't that phase two?
Yes.
The $2 million?
Yes.
But isn't that predicated on what happens to the
phase
first $100,000?
Yeah,
yes.
But there's that. But Mr. Thomas is right. There's a political signal to be sent here that is that funding agencies are going to look at very closely. The name of the game these days is cost share and leveraging funds. Nobody is going to take this seriously if there isn't a commitment up front that isn't so contingent that it can be snatched away. In fact, I would say that it might make more sense to endow it a little bit more and give it a little bit more of first year funding or first 18-month funding, which is maybe a little more realistic. Stretch phase one to, I don't even know if you said it was a year, but make it 18 months.
We didn't say it was a year.
Yeah, okay. So phase one, but not too long, just not too cold, not too hot.
but see, look at page 8. You know, you can see that phase two is really conditioned upon phase one being successful.
Yes.
And so that's why I was thinking
but
this
I'm
was
suggesting
happening
that
sequentially.
I'm suggesting to back off the conditionality a little bit in order to signal the seriousness of the commitment here. I do think this is visionary, and visionary things are risky and scary because they might not work. But it's not as if the money is going to, some Pac-Man is going to come and eat up the money, the endowment. You can always reinvest the endowment into something else if we need to. So I don't feel like it's that risky. On the other hand, what you risk is not being taken seriously enough to leverage this money 10 times.
Well, if what you're saying is that we go ahead and allocate the full amount but not spend it until phase one is successful, that's certainly fine. In other words, that we're agreeing to commit
that's
to
the, that's
that.
The proposal.
Okay. All right.
So how are we addressing, how are we addressing the $100,000?
Well, I think what we ought to do before we get into details, maybe, yes.
Maybe we should continue.
I think we need to, there's a lot of people who want to address this issue that we should hear from.
We also have the rest of the staff presentation.
Yeah. We're kind of jumping ahead of ourselves a little bit.
Yes.
You never know what we may hear that may change our mind. So.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Okay. That is, in the interest of time, you know, there was a little bit more to add, but I think we've covered 99% of it. The next presentation is by Karen Worster for the CCAMP program. Would you like to take a break before we do that?
Yeah.
Yes, okay. 10-minute break?
Yes.
We can do that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, let's resume. And we're going to hear more about C-Camp? Okay.
Now is it on? Now it's on. Okay. Very happy to be here on an auspicious date, which is the approximate 10-year anniversary of the start of our program, Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program. I'm quite proud of that, and I wanted to just take a minute before we get started to recognize the crew. Sitting behind me is Mary Adams, who is... she's just the steam behind this program. What else can I say? And she's been with us for 9 years, 9 of the 10 years, heading up the sampling effort, data management effort. She keeps everybody in line, and she's been great. Dave Paradis, sitting in the back, has been with me the entire 10 years, helping us get our software development in place, working through the Bay Foundation, More Bay. And Erin Kersel, in the very back, is... she powers through the sampling for us and gets a huge amount of field work done and has been a wonderful addition to our staff. So I'm going to thank them all. And that's the extent of our crew. It's not a very large group, and we managed to accomplish a lot in 10 years. So I'm going to spend some time today talking about what we've done and how we've managed to do it, particularly because it's involved some strategies like the ones we're talking about here today, some innovative funding approaches, where we want to go with our program, and how you can help us get there. As you know, we have two primary program components. One is our watershed rotation monitoring, where we sample at about 30 sites in each of these watershed areas. over a course of 5 years, we rotate through the entire area. We sample monthly, which is pretty high-density data for other similar programs. And in this period of time, we've sampled at 183 sites in the region and have made well over 150,000 water quality measurements. The other primary program component is our coastal confluences monitoring, which is more or less our long-term trend monitoring at the bottom ends of our watersheds. We have 33 sites that we sample also monthly, ongoing, and we've been doing that since 2001, getting to a point where we can actually show trends in our data. And let me just show you some of that data right now. And I just wanted to mention, too, that if you look at the watershed area monitored by these sites, it amounts to well over 90% of our region's watershed area. This is a couple of long-term trends for two of the creeks in our region. Franklin Creek is down near Carpinteria. This is where we had some work on greenhouses a number of years ago. We have shown a significant downward trend in nitrate concentrations there. And the Santa Maria River, where although this trend is not significant, it appears to be going upward. You can see here we have a data hiatus around 2003. That was in a result of both a funding cut combined with some contracting delays that caused us to shut our program down entirely for that period of time. And that has made trend detection a lot more challenging to have breaks in data streams like that. We do a robust suite of analytes for our monthly sampling, but notice it's for conventional measurements, physical measurements like oxygen, flow, and a number of lab analyses, including nutrients, solids, chlorophyll A, salts, and coliform. Also, at a subset of our sites annually within our watershed rotation, we look at a couple of biological metrics. This one is benthic invertebrate measures of stream bottom health, helps us understand the site integrity. And we've done it at a, as I mentioned, a subset of our sites throughout the region. And the same is true for toxicity. We look at three water column species and a sediment species to investigate toxicity at our sites. Another great tool we've had available to us is our, thanks to Dave's software development, is our website. And I happen to know that when this website goes down, I almost always get a phone call from somebody. So it gets used not just by staff, but by folks out in the rest of the world. And we show our data in all kinds of formats, including maps like these, graphs, charts, summary tables. This happens to be Santa Maria data for nitrate again. You can see we have some pretty high values there. I don't know if you can see the scale, but the top numbers are up around 70 milligrams per liter. CCAMP data has been used to identify a number of impaired water bodies in our region. And we've made identified over 70 new listings to the 303D list. This is in 38 different water bodies throughout the region. You can see quite a few new listings in the Salinas area and the Santa Maria area as a result of our monitoring efforts. And what we're working on right now is the 2008 listing. And there are new requirements to develop what we call lines of evidence for that listing. And this looks like a lot of text, but this is what our software actually spits out for each line of evidence. A line of evidence is basically for a water body, for a pollutant, for a particular beneficial use, and its associated criteria. Basically, what does the data say about it, and what's the quality of that data? In this case, this is for boron on San Antonio River. We had 22 samples, zero exceedances. And the recommendation is a do not list status for that particular parameter. So we've generated almost 5,000 lines of evidence from our data alone. And that does not include what we'll be adding in from other data sources for this listing. So we have a huge amount of information we're compiling for the new 2008 listing. We've also made our assessment reports, a report on our Central Coast harbors. These are all peer-reviewed. They're available on our website as are several scientific articles that we are co-authors on. CCAMP program, the second rotation, we've really tried to focus on more a direct follow-up with other programs within our office, with the enforcement folks, stormwater, agricultural program staff, local agencies, and landowners. I think you're familiar with this particular site where we actually had a trail of broccoli labels and toxicity coming out of this drain, and that problem was resolved. I think there was a $100,000-plus settlement. At least the discharge was rerouted to an industrial wastewater facility. Here's another more recent example. We just moved into the Santa Barbara area from the Santa Maria area. This is in Arroyo Paradon, which is, again, down near Carpinteria. And this is a leaking hose from my water recycling system from greenhouses. Some very high nutrient water entering the creek and is creating a primary flow to the creek. After the staff inspection, the leak was immediately repaired and it's fixed.
When was this?
This was about 3 weeks ago.
No, three months ago.
3 months ago? Oops.
There's another one in the same area.
Oh, sorry.
3 months ago?
It was when I learned about it 3 weeks ago. One thing we're working on right now is a better approach to tracking the problems that we and other folks, other staff, find in the field. Sometimes it's a problem will get observed, but it's not always obvious you know, who's going to be the lead, how we can make sure that a problem gets followed up on. And so we're putting together a tracking system where field observations can be documented, and we can assign leads to these problems and track progress on them. And we're looking right now at integrating this with some other tracking systems that exist in our office, primarily the enforcement tracking system as well as a stormwater complaint system. So we're hoping that by pulling these together into a more cohesive approach, we'll be able to track some of the problems we find in the field through to their resolution. CCAMP developed a web-based data delivery system for the ag program back when it was originated that basically files are delivered through the web, and there's a web checker that helps look over those files for consistency with our data management structure and the SWAMP requirements. We've used that same format to compile our data for the 303D listing, so we now have a vast number of data lines of data in that same format. We're getting quite a lot of attention at a statewide level for this because, actually we've gotten not just attention but also funding through the state to adapt this system, and this is, I'm talking about Dave's work here, to adapt this system for uptaking data through the grants programs and through citizens monitoring programs. So this is really wonderful for the state and for monitoring in general, but what I think is most critical for us is it means the tools that we've developed here locally are going to get institutionalized through the state system, so we know we're going to have some support. For example, right now the ag program struggles with the data deliveries through the Cooperative Monitoring Program for Agriculture. It's a lot of work to stay on top of the quality assurance. So we're going to actually get some support to do that through the state and some staffing. So it's really important news for us. We've also been working on a flow model over the years that is getting a lot better as it goes. That's been supporting some of the calculations that are used by the Central Coast Long-Term Assessment Environmental Assessment Network, CLEAN, and some of the UC Davis research projects associated with marine mammal health to estimate loading of pollutants to the ocean. And we're looking at collaborating with researchers at the Bodega Bay Marine Lab to improve that model. They're interested in including current and wind data in with that to increase its efficacy. This is an example of 3 months of modeling from flows year 2000, in the winter of 2000. And basically, it's using an underlying USGS model and fine-tuning it to more local flow gauges in our region. And then it's actually using our own CCAMP flow data to basically test the model. Right. I guess the importance of this, we think, is there some opportunities here, perhaps to partner with the Department of Fish and Game, marine protected areas, in terms of understanding loading of the pollutants that are coming off the land at our coastal confluences sites and potentially entering the ocean and impacting marine protected areas. In this graphic, it's a little hard to see, but these little blue areas are right now the only marine protected areas in the state of California. And the green dots are coastal confluence sites. And you'll see there's a pretty good concurrence of the two together. You have a coastal confluence site at all the marine protected areas except the ones, the ones offshore, the islands. I want to talk a bit about how we've managed the work we've done. First of all, we have a very cost-efficient sampling approach. We have our own sampling team. Most other regions contract out all their sampling. If we kept the same level of monitoring that we do, contracted through SWAMP, it would cost us almost $1 million a year just in getting to the sampling sites. As it is, we currently spend about $80,000 to fund sampling staff. And CCAMP works as a partnership with the Bay Foundation. Right now, the Bay Foundation is funding the sampling staff for the program. I guess my point there, that funding is from our existing endowment. If we didn't have that funding, we would not be doing anything like the level of sampling that we're doing.
Okay. Karen, yes. Just one clarification. You said the Bay Foundation is funding the sampling staff, but it's coming from $80,000 that we've endowed. Is that how that works?
Right, that's exactly right. That there's two sources of funds there now, including original funds from the Guadalupe Settlement Agreement. What we found is that when we, in working with a foundation, it enables the CCAMP program to have the foundation provides staffing that have benefits, workers' compensation. They can be full-time employees as opposed to part-time students, for instance. So it gives them a lot more security. In addition, the CCAMP program manager position was put together from contributions from other water board programs. We don't actually have a PY, so to speak, position authority for my position through our monitoring funding. The SWAMP program, which is the state surface water ambient monitoring program, only funds 8/10 of a staff position to CCAMP. So we've taken a really creative approach to this issue.
Karen.
Yes.
In the interest of time, could I just ask you to summarize for us how you would utilize the increased funding?
Sure.
And,
it's
and
way
that's
down
because
here.
Your staff report was very thorough. And
okay.
I know that I think most of us read
that's
it
okay.
quite well. And if the board has specific questions, perhaps they can ask
sure.
you about it. But I'd like to get to the core of how the money would be used.
Okay. Well,
and that's not there. Because I don't like listening to you talk and tell us about this stuff, because it is very important. I just want to try to move it along for us.
Okay. It wasn't that far along, but the things that we want to do, maybe I should go farther forward. I'll try to go fast. How about that? We're trying to take our data and move towards a multi-metric approach for measuring health. And an example here is to take the three measures of biological health that we currently monitor for and use them in combination to assess health of a site. And here's an example of that. And I think the most important thing to point out here is that in having missing information, in components of the metric and in some of the upstream areas that are unassessed, we have less capability to assess the overall watershed health. I'll skip past that. We want to really spend a lot more of our effort on linking water quality trends to land use data. And just referring back to this graphic, this is nitrate data in the Santa Maria watershed. We've noted when we did this graphic that two of these sites used to be yellow or green, so water quality is actually changed in the period of time that we've been monitoring, in this case, for the worst at these sites, which are located right here. And that's the data from those sites from 2000 and 2007. So we want to expand that type of analysis and coordination with other board programs, making sure that we can do these things repeatedly to support our vision efforts.
So the where we want to go is what the additional funds will get, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
It gets more detailed. But as I mentioned, we'd really like to coordinate more with other agency programs. We have talked to Ocean Protection Council folks, and Resources Legacy Foundation folks about coordinating in terms of our monitoring at coastal confluences with regard to marine protected areas. Also, in terms of the critical steelhead habitat, a lot of the upper watersheds we have here, you can see there aren't a lot of the blue lines here are critical habitat for steelhead. And you can see in a lot of some of the upper watershed areas, we have no monitoring going on in these sites. And I think what I wanted to point out here is there's been a project funded by the Sanctuary, that Synthesis Assessment and Management Project. And one thing that they did is pull multiple data sources together into our format to look at what we could say with all of the monitoring data and look at gaps. And what we did see is that there's a lot of data of certain kinds and not very much of other kinds, like metals and organics. And of course, these are more expensive, more complex analytes to measure. And so that was one thing that was apparent. Another thing, a conclusion of the study, was there's not a lot of monitoring in upper watersheds. And finally, the CCAMP serves as the backbone for the monitoring effort in the region in terms of where the data is coming from and in terms of the quality assurance and the integrity and the ongoing nature of it. It's not grant data, for example. We do not routinely sample any of these things, pesticides, metals, sedimentation, emerging contaminants. So though we have a good, solid program, there's a lot we're not doing. And we've estimated that to fully implement CCAMP using an endowment-type strategy, we'd require something on the order of $20 million. Today we're asking for $4.65 million. I think I've already talked to you about our state funding situation, which has been unstable at best. We're looking at 10% cuts to state agencies this year. Endowment funding provides not only a stable source of income, but a flexible source of income in terms of how it can be used. Sure.
The green line you see at the top there going into the future, that's what the endowment would provide. So, Chairman Young, you were asking, what is it going to provide? What it provides is stability in funding, so we eliminate the gaps that we see in our funding over time, the temporal gaps.
One of the challenges with unstable funding is just projecting what you're going to be able to do the next year and following through with it in terms of contracting. It makes it very difficult to maintain
And the state water board funding you use only for the laboratory costs?
Right now, that is what we're using it for, yeah. We use it for the contract laboratory we use, and then we say do some small component of our sampling. So what would the income from these new funds be able to buy us? The first most important thing, as I mentioned, is stability. But it could also, for example, provide 20 additional sites to our watershed rotation to greatly increase our resolution in our upper watersheds or in other parts of the watershed. So right now we have 30 sites, so it's a significant increase the amount of sampling we do in our watershed rotation. Right now we have no metals monitoring. We could add metals monitoring at all sites. We could do a riparian health assessment at all sites. Right now we've had to cut our bioassessment budget in Santa Barbara area because we wanted to keep our toxicity sampling. We cut it out entirely. We could add bioassessment back in. It would give us additional foundation positions to support data management and field services. And that actually is a big stumbling block for how much we can just physically get done, especially because we have superhumans on staff that are not replaceable in terms of the amount of work they can do. And I think maybe one of the most important pieces, we have never had a budget for follow-up of any kind. You know, we pretty much know to the number how many sites we're funding based on our sampling plan. What this buys us is a budget to do some type of follow-up when we find problems, when we have contaminants that we haven't been able to monitor routinely that we're concerned about. It gives us some flexibility about investigating problems. As I mentioned, we are seeking funding from other sources, in particular to look more comprehensively at loading to the ocean. So today we're requesting that you approve the $4.65 million to increase the CCAMP endowment. And why you should support this request is so that we as an agency can be accountable for our performance. This data helps us understand where our priority problems are. It helps us increase our responsiveness to those problems. It helps support and defend your requirements and prioritize your actions. It can inform us of how effective our actions are, so if we know whether we need to adjust those programs. It will allow us to continue measuring the key parameters we need to measure in order to determine whether we're achieving our goals behind you there, and ultimately to help us truly understand whether our watersheds, where our watersheds are healthy and whether they're getting healthier. That's it.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Press.
Have you tried to increase the endowment with grants? I mean, one of the things that makes this proposal compelling is that nobody cares about monitoring. It's just
It is first thing to get cut.
Yeah, and so, but some organizations are coming around. Have you ever tried to specifically not for projects but for endowment?
No, but I think we looked into this a bit. I think it's going to be a real challenge to do it, just like Michael was mentioning earlier. Most the grant sources that are available to us, at least through the state, are, first of all, typically limited for even doing any monitoring, much less funding an endowment to do monitoring.
Well, I'm thinking of the, I'm thinking that if your endowment was increased today, that might be an opportunity to go to the private sector and say, well, look, you know, this is how just how serious it is. Nobody else is doing this, and this is really an opportunity to start leveraging that money. So that's one observation. The other, you said, getting to the constituents that you would add, have you thought about what metals you're going to add? Like, I didn't see methyl mercury.
Yeah, no, my priority metals were copper and zinc.
But what about mercury?
Yeah.
Why not?
It's funding related. You know, if we did it at all sites, it eats up the budget pretty quickly. It's the kind of thing that if you did as a follow-up component at high-risk sites, you could do it easily. If you did it at all sites all the time.
But I'm thinking here, again, if I was trying to sell CCAMP to funders who don't know from monitoring, they have heard about mercury bioaccumulation in fish and that you're not supposed to eat tuna, blah, 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 blah. So that mercury is in their minds, whereas zinc and copper may not be. That's one thing. The other is that you might also get money to do E. coli because of the food safety issue. So I'm wondering if you've thought about the politics or the political aspect of what you select to go into, because if you go into certain analytes, you can then go to funding sources that are more familiar with those analytes and kind of get some money for that.
Yeah.
So I would urge you to go to think about that strategically.
Okay.
Oh, we did get funding for E. coli.
Right. But it's a set amount of money.
But it's not endowment money. Whereas if you could get endowment money, you could say you could go to a funder and you could say, see, this is a big problem. Give us some endowment money here so we can take it to this other level. I mean, it doesn't really affect what we're doing here, but I'm trying to think strategically so that we leverage what we're doing here. And you don't just pick up zinc and copper, but you pick up more because people have certain contaminants in their minds.
Mm-hmm. Yep, we've actually talked about this quite a bit, where we want to make this part of attracting other funding is to make the program as transparent as possible and make the data as available as possible to other entities. And we're trying to do that by using this web-based approach. And I think Karen and Dave Perry have done a remarkable job in that sense of building that website.
Yeah.
We need to get it out there more. You know, we need to do more work to get it out there so
and
more
and
people
I'm just
know
saying,
about
I'm just
it.
Saying that sometimes you need to sing a hummable tune that people recognize, and they don't necessarily know some of these tunes. If they've heard some of these other ones, then you'll get in the door that way, and then you'll get them to come along with your other constituents. Pharmaceuticals would be another.
Right. I'm really hoping we have some opportunities with the marine protected areas to partner there, because I really think, you know, we're so perfectly poised to help provide them with water quality information. So in terms of we have the infrastructure, we have, you know, it's just that.
That's right.
We're not sampling everything they'd be interested in.
There's no other monitoring program set up like this one to measure pollutant loading to marine protected areas. And so we're going to try and capitalize on that.
Okay. Any other board questions or comments at this point in time? We've got about 20 cards. So I wanted to move through those, and we can then, Dr. Hunter?
I have one question, and it concerns, in the staff report, there was the mention of the watershed coordinator position for Santa Maria Watershed Basin and Basin. Is that the appropriate time to bring that up?
Sure.
Yeah. I note that the funding for that has come from the Guadalupe Dunes Settlement Fund, and you're proposing that shift to other sources of funds. So questions I have, where is that position currently housed? Who handles it now?
The Watershed Coalition is an organization that exists, and I believe Kevin Merrill, who's president of that organization, is here.
Mm-hmm.
So he could answer the question about where it's housed and how it works much better than I could.
We got a speaker card for him.
So maybe he can address that. So is there, I know that there are watershed coordinators throughout the region, and they are funded by the State Board, they're funded by Department of Conservation.
All different sources.
And so I know this year in particular there was a point at which half a dozen of them were looking at 2 months of funding and no promise for maintaining those positions.
Yeah.
I'm concerned that we don't have a stronger plan to see some consistency. If this is one we can continue.
Yep.
What's your plan?
We're looking for other funding sources. We're actively looking for other funding sources right now. Enforcement actions that we have going. Mm-hmm. I can't go into detail about enforcement actions, future potential enforcement actions or existing ones. But as you know, there are special environmental projects associated mm-hmm. with funding actions. We're looking at those right now. And there are other grant opportunities coming up, grant cycles coming up, and we're also looking at those. Our grants program manager is aware of the need to fund this position, mm-hmm. as well as our ag program manager. So we're actively looking at those other sources and how much is available there and the type of funding or the type of projects that would be funded by those other grants.
So would you say there's no real jeopardy that position would fade, or there'd be a gap, we'd lose a experienced staffer there, or
I would say that I think it's likely that we'll find funding. I can't say how much funding. So is it? It's hard for me to estimate the risk to the position. The last time the board funded it at a significant amount, over $600,000, I believe.
And I think that was 4 years of funding?
Yes, 4 or 5 years of funding.
Uh-huh.
And they also had some match funding.
Uh-huh. So is there any way to leave this item open? I mean, it seems like a year-to-year kind of consideration would be a much smaller amount than $600,000, but I would be really interested to see that this particular position gets supported until it transitions to something more secure.
Mm-hmm.
Not that we continue to fund it,
mm-hmm.
Indefinitely, but that we assure that the person with the experience conducting the program is not lost through a 3-month or 6-month gap in funding, because replacing those people is very, very challenging.
Mm-hmm.
I know you all understand that. But mm-hmm. a person who has not only the technical skills but the ability to work with landowners in a very challenging political and economic and social climate,
yep.
With all of the components of the ag water quality program, food safety, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So those positions are just critical
mm-hmm.
right now.
Yes, and this one is in particular because Kay Mercer has done a great job of being the coordinator, and we have the ag requirements being renewed at the beginning of 2009, and so mm-hmm. that position mm-hmm. is really important for that process.
Yeah, so rapport with the community in that process is irreplaceable. So I would like to propose that we allow for a transition to other funds, but that we assure that the position doesn't go unfunded.
Well, when they're going to speak, and so we'll have some questions for them.
Well, I guess my concern is that, in the resolution, it's not named.
Right, and we're not at the resolution yet. That's kind of, that'll be the last thing we deal with.
Okay.
And your questions are good questions that I think they'll be able to answer for us in terms of what their projected needs are.
Mm-hmm.
But
I guess the question I have is that something we can add to this resolution?
Oh, I think we can do whatever we want with the resolution.
Great.
Yeah, it's our resolution.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds good to me.
Okay.
And we, on page 7 of the supplemental sheet, we did say staff is proposing that the board allocate any remaining Guadalupe settlement funds or funds that are returned to the account due to non-performance to this project pending review of the proposal. So we're saying it's not automatically granted. However, those funds that are remaining would be held in reserve to be able to take an opportunity later to look at the proposal. they're funded through the end of this calendar year, so it's premature for them to submit a thorough proposal at this time.
Okay, I'm a little confused. So you're referring to page 7, but I'm working from the yellow supplemental that came in.
It says prepared on January 31st.
Is that the most recent one? Because it's not. There is no page 7, and they're not listed at all.
Right. This is the supplemental staff report.
Okay.
Not the resolution.
Okay. Well, that was my concern. Is that it doesn't appear on this document, and
right.
So that I wanted to raise that question.
Okay.
Any other board questions or comments before we go to our cards? Okay. We'll go to our speaker cards. Go through these as quickly as we can. Phil Henry, South Coast Advisory Council.
Oh, he had to leave.
He had to leave. Okay.
He submitted the letter, though.
Yeah, he did. And I did see him outside. And he shared a few thoughts with me. Kay Mercer. Or whoever wants, or Kevin Merrill. You want to go first, Mr. Merrill? And then Kay Mercer, and then Herb Candell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and fellow board members. You have to excuse me, I got a little bit of bronchitis, so I hope I can get through this quickly. I appreciate Dr. Hunter's remarks, and As you understand, our funding is up at the end of this year in November. We came here today to make sure that you understood exactly what we were doing out there, and what an integral part our coalition and in particular Kay Mercer played in having the conditional ag waiver be a success here on the Central Coast. As you're all aware, that's a Herculean effort to get that done. And we are a shining example in the state of California, I think, for working together with not only the staff that we have an excellent rapport with and the agricultural community, which is not an easy group to get together. So our coalition has worked hand-in-hand with Preservation, Inc. We continue to do so today. We know that the ag waiver is coming down the line again. We know that Santa Maria River is looking at a TMDL program down there that is going to rely on much of what the ag waiver best management practices are to contribute to that. And so we want to make sure that, as Dr. Hunter said, we want to maintain that goodwill, if you will, between the agricultural community and your board to make sure that we continue down the path that we're on now, and that's getting farmers to understand this is important with all the things they have to be faced with today. As you're well aware, regulation after regulation, water being important to them, but staying in business also is another one. With all the regulations, they rely on Kay to keep them apprised of what's going on, and it's extremely important. So with that, I think you understand the job we've done here. I think Allison and her staff, we have worked really well with together. Karen's staff as well. I think, like I say, it is a poster child for how well things could get along. We don't always get along. You see things eye to eye, but we have made this process work when many people thought it didn't have a chance. And it's taken a lot of hard work and a lot of volunteer hours. Not only, Kay is our only paid person online here. I put in a tremendous amount of hours volunteering on this, not only this coalition, but for Preservation, Inc. as well. I'm the president of that, too. How I get into these things, I'm not quite sure. But anyway, we have done a real good job with it, and we appreciate the board's support in all of them, and we like to continue on in that vein throughout the next conditional waiver. So thank you for your support, and I'll turn it over to Kay.
One question.
Sure.
The position is actually housed through the Ag Water Quality Coalition?
That's correct. The Central Coast Wine Growers Foundation administers the grant, and in so doing provides an office for Kay and Santa Maria at their offices down there.